Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed on TNT. I'm your host, Mark Morano. All right. We begin hour two. Joe Biden boasts that he's cutting carbon emissions in half by 2030. He also claims he's done more to save the planet than anyone else in history. Clip one.
I'm taking the most significant action ever on climate in the history of the world. I'm cutting our carbon emissions in half by 2030.
And there you have it. The most significant actions ever taken by anyone in the world, in the history of the world. That's impressive. What in the bleep, bleep is he even talking about? As his own climate envoy, John Kerry has said repeatedly, even if the United States miraculously went to zero emissions tomorrow, it wouldn't impact global emissions. So nothing Joe Biden could do could ever be described as significant in the history of the world when it comes to emissions, setting aside the question of whether emissions of CO2 drive climate change, which they don't. And the other thing is, and it's Steve Malloy of Junk Science, who's been on this program last week, Biden's own energy department belies and debunks what Biden just said about cutting carbon emissions in half by 2030. The emission cuts don't even get to cut in half by 2050 based on their fantasy-based models of the future, almost two decades out. It's just incredible that grown men write this stuff in a speech and the president of the United States reads it off a teleprompter. The most significant actions in the history of the planet. Huh? What? Are you going to also stop continental drift? Are we going to stop the seasonal cycles? Are we going to stop the tilt of the Earth's axis? Are we going to stop a volcano? What are you talking about? This goes back to what Sam Sorbo said in the previous hour. People are being dumbed down so much to be obedient, to go along with whatever the latest thing is. Oh, well, I'm on that thing. You know, Afghanistan, oh, now we're on to Ukraine. Oh, let's support Ukraine. That's the most important thing. We need to do Ukraine. I don't know. Okay. This is Patrick Moore on climate change. And this is the Patrick Moore. Extreme weather events have been going on since the beginning of man. There is no change. And there's no evidence of a climate catastrophe. Clip two, Greenpeace co-founder Patrick Moore, who I'd like to get on. He was on my show when it was audio only on TNT. I'd like to bring him back on to do a full presentation. The man is a font of knowledge on environmental issues. And I'm talking about everything from plastics to recycling to deforestation, species. I mean, this man is the man. He's a PhD ecologist. Clip two, Dr. Patrick Moore, co-founder of Greenpeace.
The truth of the matter is there is no evidence of a climate catastrophe. All they're talking about now is extreme weather events, which have been going on since the beginning of time, and forest fires, for goodness sake. The reason that these fires are so severe today is due to mismanagement. If you imagine back in the day when I was talking about when all energy was from wood, every end of every summer, the people went out from cities and towns and gathered all the dead wood in the forest. That's the first they would take because it's the easiest to take and it's already dry. So this really reduces the chance of a catastrophic wildfire.
Dr. Patrick Moore, reminds me of a couple things on this. At the Johannesburg, South Africa Earth Summit, I went to South Africa for 2 weeks in 2002. He was one of the first people I interviewed when I hit the ground running in South Africa at this Earth Summit. It was my first UN summit of any kind in 2002. And I remember sitting through a presentation interviewing him, and I was blown away. I'd already met him back in the 90s. He did help me with, I interviewed him for my Amazon rainforest documentary. But he's talking about wood there, aside from climate crisis. And he said some profound things. He said, if you want more trees, use more wood. And I'm like, huh? Oh, we're supposed to be cutting down. We're supposed to be using, you know, we're going to be making huts made from, you know, recycled hemp or something. And it turns out he was saying that when you use trees, it sends a signal to the marketplace that you need more, that they need to grow more trees, and that trees are valuable, and that you can, that you can then treasure a resource. So the more you have it, the more it's valued. Similar things have happened with, you know, saving elephants in South Africa and the ivory tusks. If you allow a limited market for the tusks, the ivory tusks that aren't black market, you actually get them better protected than if you allow just the black market and ban all trade, because then they end up with poachers, which they can't control. And so that ends up the elephants get hurt. There's more than multiple ways to skin a cat and different ways you need to look at it. But the other thing, as I mentioned about Dr. Patrick Moore, and this is profound, he was one of the founding members of Greenpeace. And you know how I know this? Because Greenpeace itself, on their website for decades, listed him. They listed his name. They had an original document that showed the original signers of formation of Greenpeace. They had his photo up. He had a dedicated page about the history of Greenpeace. He was listed as a founding member by Greenpeace until he started speaking out against the climate crisis. And he became a dissenter of that whole view and a lot of other issues. What did Greenpeace do? They started revising their own history. He wasn't a founder. That's not true. I remember so many times writing stories about Dr. Patrick Moore and people saying, you know, you can't say that. He isn't a founding member. Greenpeace says he was not a founding member. You're lying. You need a retraction. And then Greenpeace got to Google. And Google started erasing Dr. Patrick Moore from any web searches. So if you looked up Greenpeace co-founders, he didn't exist anymore. Greenpeace removed him from their own webpage. Greenpeace removed it, and then in a partnership with Google, wiped him. And very similar to, if you ever see a book called The Commissar Vanishes about Joseph Stalin, when his Soviet commissars, his henchmen essentially, would be in good standing. They'd be taking a lot of photos with Stalin as, you know, loyal team members. When they fell out of favor or did something unapproved by the Soviet system, they were airbrushed and erased from photos. And you can look at before and after photos. They're just, you're gone. You're a non-person. You've been canceled. You've been deplatformed. You've been defunded. You no longer exist. Boy, that sounds a lot like today's culture, a little borrowing from the old Soviet system. But what's most significant is the Wayback Machine, the Wayback Machine is the one that saved the truth. And we were able to show, by going to the Wayback Machine, the screenshots, the URLs of Greenpeace's own website showing Dr. Patrick Moore as a founding member. Plus, Dr. Patrick Moore had tons of photos. He had his own letters and documents and all the stuff. But my point is, and people would dispute that, oh, what does he present? You know, they didn't care what Dr. Patrick Moore said. But once you presented him with the evidence of what Greenpeace had said for decades, suddenly everyone went silent. And now when I post co-founding member of Greenpeace, I don't hear much pushback, if at all. I don't think I've heard anything in years, because it was a con and a lie. He was a co-founding member. The con and the lie was Greenpeace erased him from their own history. And it just goes to show you this. And also, it goes to show you the Wayback Machine. I still can't believe that exists. And it apparently, from my knowledge, and I look at this every month, I go through Wayback Machine, fascinated by it. It's unadulterated, as far as I can tell. I could be wrong. But the day they come after that, that's the last saving grace. I remember I was on Stuart Varney on Fox News. This is 7 or 8 years ago, saying, how much longer can the Wayback Machine exist? Because it's so easy to debunk the lies of people today when they say, well, according to this, like, oh, really? Well, that's not what this organization said for years. And you could actually find out what they said as a snapshot in time. And that's what Wayback Machine is. It captures websites and URLs, snapshot in time, and preserves it in infamy forever, in perpetuity, allegedly. Will they get to that? Certainly expected, and not beyond the pale that they would get to that. Anyway, okay. There's an ad that I thought was just fantastic about stopping the banning of gas-powered cars. The American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturing, yes, big industry, actually is finally fighting back. This is a 30-second ad defending gas-powered cars, going after electric car mandates and gas-powered car bans. Roll clip 3.
You're in the driver's seat. You choose what road to take. But soon, you'll be taking a backseat to big government. The Biden administration is rushing to ban new gas-powered cars. They've made it clear, it's their way or the highway. Even if electric vehicles aren't right for you or your family. Call the White House and tell President Biden to stop the car ban. Don'tBanOurCars.com. Paid for by American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers.
Very good, I think. And great website, great name, Stop the Car Ban. I mean, I have a question. It's 2024. Where the bleep, bleep have the Republican leaders? Where was Kevin McCarthy? Where was Mitch McConnell? This should have been daily press conferences, daily legislation, daily hearings. This would have captured the imagination during the midterms. Instead, it's just like they leave it to the wonkism of this. Well, are cars being banned? Well, the EPA is mandating corporate average fuel economy standards, which make it very hard. They're being banned. It's the car ban. It's the intent to prevent us from freedom of movement, to ration vehicles. So we'll be similar to, you know, the old Cuban system where you have 1950s cars will have frozen in time here, or the old East German system where you're going to have one government approved car instead of the EV. It used to be the crappy Trabant, which people had to be on waiting lists for 5-10 plus years to get this crappy, I think it was a 2 or 3 cylinder vehicle. And this is what people are accepting. Now, I shouldn't say they're accepting it because it's not real to it yet, to them yet. And that's what we have to see now, because once these things become real, people tend to slough it off and they get terrified. In fact, there's a breaking news story out of Europe, out of the EU. EU may scrap its plan to ban the internal combustion engine by 2035. This is according to the No Trick Zone website, notrickzone.com, by Pierre Gosselin. After a vote in Brussels Monday evening of this week, a majority of the European Parliament favored a commission proposal that would no longer automatically classify electric cars as climate neutral vehicles. And of course, they're not. In the proposal, the CO2 emissions of electric cars would depend on electricity mix used to charge the car. Yeah. So if you have an electric car, first of all, studies have shown that even with the weight, extra weight in the tire, that you miss more environmental pollutants or particulate matter if you're worried that that's a pollutant. And if you have this electric car that takes 500,000 pounds of materials to make 1,000-pound electric car battery, and you're charging it on a fossil fuel grid, is it really climate neutral by your little bookkeeping definition? Of course not. In the proposal, CO2 cars would depend on the electricity mix. The EU plans to reassess the phase out of combustion engines based on the latest data and developments. Huge, 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 huge. So what has brought about this sudden episode of political sobriety? This is according to notrickzone.com, Pierre Gosselin column. Probably a good dose of reality. Here are 4 possible reasons behind the EU's new position to reconsider gas-powered car bans. China. The automotive industry and many EU states warn of the economic social consequence of a ban on combustion engines. Electric car production in Europe cannot compete with China. China is already becoming the number one global automaker, passing US, South Korea. It's phenomenal how it's almost like we're just saying, hey, we have to help China. What can we do? I know, let's ban gas-powered cars. E-car emission cheating. Currently, electric cars in the EU are given a CO2 emission rating of 0 grams. The emission claim is a lie because the calculations doesn't take into the electrical generation mix into which the car charges. Climate neutral fuels. Efforts are being made to run combustion engines on climate neutral fuels, e-fuels, which are produced from renewable energy and are thus CO2 neutral. But they want to re-examine whether newly registered vehicles with combustion engines that run on e-fuels can be registered from 2035. The EU Parliament election. Ah, we're getting to the real reason, and the fact that people are starting to understand, like, wait, I'm sorry, You effer, mother effers did what? You banned gas-powered cars? In many, many cases, these are just unelected bureaucrats doing this. The EU may be realizing that banning the internal combustion engine and replacing them with e-cars is going to cause a lot more damage than good. So that's positive news coming out of the EU. Okay. We had Sam Sorbo on the last hour, and she was talking about transgender. Spent a lot of time on this in the PSYOP. And how do you deal with this? I mentioned Joseph Stalin and his commissar vanishes, and how when you fell out of favor with the state, you'd be deplatformed, canceled, censored, defunded. Look at Roseanne Barr. Roseanne, I guess it just goes by Roseanne. What happened to her when she did one tweet that went viral against Valerie Jarrett? She lost her ABC show. She became a persona non grata overnight. Well, one person, and she continues to fight, and she's fought all that, and she's been a beacon of fighting back against this whole cancel culture. Another person has been J.K. Rowling, the author. She's hitting back at misgendering accusations. She's not backing down. This is clip four. I believe it's Australian Sky News, if I'm not mistaken. And this is great because it just shows you, first of all, the absurdity of the charges against you if you don't go along with the transgender. And secondly, it's not that hard to have the courage. Now, she's a billionaire many times over, the author of the Harry Potter stories. So she can afford to maybe be canceled, defunded, censored. I don't know that that's true. The point is she's leading the way. She should be praised for this. Clip four.
J.K. Rowling has hit back at accusations she misgendered a newsreader. A UK transgender news anchor reported the Harry Potter author to police for misgendering her as a man on social media. After doing so, India Willoughby fronted the cameras for an interview where she claimed that J.K. Rowling's words made her the victim of a hate crime.
And for J.K. Rowling to deliberately, and that is the key word, misgender me, knowing who I am, is grossly offensive. It is a hate crime.
For context, J.K. Rowling and India Willoughby have been locked in a war of words on X for more than a year. Last January, India Willoughby posted, "I'm more of a woman than J.K. Rowling will ever be." But the latest row kicked off earlier this week when J.K. Rowling highlighted issues about trans women being allowed in female locker rooms.
We need more J.K. Rowlings fighting this. This was a author. She was fated by the establishment, by the mainstream, by Hollywood, by movie, the entertainment industry, movies, books. And she took this on, and she's taking a heavy hit to her job, to her performance, to her whole enterprise. And it's just great to see her not backing down. It really is. And the absurdity of like, oh, I was misgendered. Oh, my feelings are hurt. Oh, anyway, it's such nonsense. All right, final clip for today. If you thought the Hollywood Oscars in 2024 were free of politics, I submit to you this Stephen Colbert clip five.
Emma Stone is an Oscar nominee for the fifth time, right?
That's the fifth Stephen time. What's this guy's name? Not Stephen Colbert.
You're so unbelievably great in Poor Things. Emma played an adult woman with the brain of a child.
Jimmy
like
Kimmel.
The lady who gave the rebuttal to the State of the Union on Thursday night. And you're just amazing. There were so many great movies that held audiences captive this year. And I mean that literally. Your movies were too long this year.
Jimmy Kimmel, not Stephen Colbert. The other liberal late night host. But you saw Emma Stone, that was the actress who looked very, very uncomfortable with that joke. But it's just, you know, pandering to that Hollywood crowd. I got a great clip for you tomorrow, and it's going to be Robert De Niro goes completely unhinged on Bill Maher's show about Donald Trump. I mean, I want to play the whole clip. I may play it twice and three times. It's that good. It's that telling. And there's so much analysis to be gleaned from that. So that'll be tomorrow. That was actually a relatively minor thing from the Oscars this year. Okay. So here we go. Joel Thayer will be joining us next, president of the Digital Progress Institute. And we're going to be talking about all things big tech, freedom of speech, censorship. He formerly served as a congressional staffer to honor Lee Terry and the Honorable Mary Bono. So we will be right back on Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. And Joel Thayer will be joining us. Stay tuned.
TNT's Abby Roberts.
Church of England seeks partners to create $1 billion fund to address legacy of slavery. Everybody, the Church of England, what are you doing? The Church of England will aim to turn $100 million financial commitment into a $1 billion fund to address the legacy of slavery in order to reflect the scale of moral sin. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. We need we need to get all those people out of the Church of England. What are they doing? The church should work in partnership with other organisations to create the fund that will be used, and I'm sure not used for any nefarious purposes. Oh no, raising that amount of money surely will not go into the wrong hands. Because that would never happen, would it?
Abby Roberts on TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining us now is John Thayer, president of the Digital Progress Institute. We're going to be talking about TikTok, whether it's a spy arm of the Chinese government. And also, he's a former congressional staffer for Honorable Lee Terry and Honorable Mary Bono. And I just want to mention the Digital Progress Institute was previously associate at the Phillips Little. Anyway, this is, thank you for joining the program, John.
No, thank you. And just for the record, it's Joel.
You know what? I apologize for that. I have it written both ways.
Don't worry about it at all. I'd rather be
Joel
a John.
Thayer. Okay, Joel Thayer. Sorry about that. All right, Joel. So thank you for correcting the record on that. So tell us what the Digital Progress Institute is. What issues are you working on? And what are what is your area of concern?
Yeah, so the high-level elevator pitch is that we are a bipartisan organization that seeks to find incremental progress in tech and telecom issues. We break that down into basically five categories, but I won't bore you with all five. I think the ones that are specific to the issues we're talking about today are twofold. One is obviously holistic strategies to issues with technology companies, or internet regulation at large, and also privacy for all. Those are issues where we've argued for many different legislative measures and even legal measures to ensure that we rein in big tech in a responsible way.
Okay, so we'll get to TikTok in a moment. I just want to get the big picture. What are the major problems, as you see it, with the Digital Progress Institute with big tech today? And just before you answer, you know, as I look at it, I look at big tech as a colluder with the intelligence agencies. And I look specifically at what happened during COVID, what happens on my issue of climate change, energy, all of the censorship and the pseudo fact checks that they issue and the shadow banning and the pulling and the yanking of sites. And just give me your assessment of those type of issues as well.
All the above, I guess. I think you rightly note a lot of different issues that we're seeing with tech companies, and you can sum it up in basically one concept, and that is a high concentration of power amongst a few companies. So we're talking about companies that have enveloped every aspect of our lives. Like, there's no escaping. I think Justice Kennedy pointed out that they are like our principal source of what you call like knowing like everything from events, checking ads, like appointments, speaking and listening to the modern public square. Like, they've essentially turned into a forum where free speech is supposed to reign, but it really hasn't worked out that way. It seems like there's certain speech that they like, they promote. If there's certain speech that they hate, they turn it down. And then they seek civil immunities within our legal systems to avoid any ramifications from any consumer if they have any issue when they turn up turn up the volume on a certain thing or turn the volume down on another aspect. So really, it's kind of the primary issue, as I see it, is just a highly concentrated authority over content. And they're, frankly, they're free and able to do whatever they want, whenever they want. And they can basically manipulate content any way they see fit. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, let's go back. How did it get this way? In other words, I remember the heady days of the 90s when the internet was this big promise. I remember writing absurd things like the information superhighway is going to break. Well, it wasn't absurd. It's really not absurd, but the information superhighway, the internet was going to crack open, you know, the entire information age. It was going to end totalitarian regimes. It was going to be the greatest, you know, boon to freedom ever. What happened from the 1990s to now, where it's like they're the enforcers of they're the enforcers of the establishment now, and they allow no dissent? How did that happen? Other than X, obviously, Twitter, which has changed under Elon Musk's ownership. How did we go from that? Give us some of the legislative history. Give us some of the ways this has evolved in the last 3 decades.
Well, it really comes down to a few factors. One is just the market evolved. It grew up. And when we're talking about the internet you're describing, these were, you know, very interoperable systems. They gave consumers more authority over it. And there was less of a penchant from these platforms to want to engage in your content. AOL cared very little about what you were aiming somebody else. And now I'm dating myself, so I don't know if anyone
knows
what aiming is anymore. Whereas you look at, you know, platforms like social media platforms particularly, and I mean, it's drastically different from, you know, these message to messaging systems. Now we're talking about, you know, now we're seeing that platforms are more of a curator than they were, than they are just like these passive platforms. So you asked how it got this way, and it's a bit of a complicated issue, but I think the one thing to describe, the one focal point would be that there was, from a legislative standpoint, we encourage this by passing laws like Section 230 of the Communications Act, which Section 230, for the unfamiliar, is frankly just a civil immunity that we put in statute so that a company like Twitter or Facebook can curate to their heart's content and not be held for any civil penalty, usually in the tort space. But now the way the courts have read it, they can basically do whatever they want and they can't be sued for it. So that's one giant bucket. The other bucket, I think, where there was a major turn is, well, okay, these guys aren't just they're now moderating content. So are there First Amendment applications? And to what they do, they themselves have a First Amendment application. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now in the courts. So there's a Supreme Court case right now, NetChoice v. Paxton, where they're challenging two laws, basically, one from Florida, one from Texas, where, you know, the Texas and Florida legislature are trying to rein them in and trying to rein in their power, specifically as it relates to their curation practices, like putting non-discrimination rules. The tech companies feel like that's inappropriate because the First Amendment allows them to do this. So what they're really trying to do here is get both Section 230 immunities to, you know, allow anything on their platform that they want and then say they have no responsibility for that content. And then on the other hand, they're saying, well, we're actually publishers now and we are the same as a newspaper. So even if we do curate, we're still protected under the First Amendment. They basically want a giant bulwark in order to protect them from any responsibility to the American public, which is very bizarre.
Well, let's go back to that. But you said the Section 230, what year? That was 97 or something. Was that right? That was something.
96.
96. What should have been done? Was that a bad piece of legislation? Instead of that, do you have an alternative? I mean, I'm not an expert on this issue. I try to follow some of the basics, but it's always confused me. I hear people say no. I hear a libertarian say, you know, you would need to leave. There's a big debate even among conservatives, libertarians, free speech advocates. What should they have done instead of Section 230? And how could we have avoided the sort of the where we are today with big tech?
Oh, that's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? So I don't think that you can go back in terms of like, let's have a
Yeah, it's a thought experiment. I'm not really.
I know. I know you're not suggesting let's get a DeLorean and punch it to 88 and go back to 96 and figure this out. My instinct is to always react to how the market has shifted and look at whether or not these statutory immunities make sense in today's internet. And frankly, I think that it's a very easy solution. I've always advocated for tethering a Section 230 immunity to a public accommodation. So that way, or non-discrimination rules. So if like a platform does decide that, you know, they're just going to let anything on their platform, their free speech, they're not really engaging, or they're not discriminating on the basis of some criteria like your race, your gender, your political ideology, then you know what? Fine. They get the Section 230 immunity. Go for it. Go forth and do. However, if it turns out that they are using their terms of service as a mechanism to silence either Republicans, Libertarians, Democrats, okay, well, now you're no longer a passive platform. You are now a publisher and you should be held accountable to those decisions. Your Section 230 immunity should go away when you make those types of decisions. I just think that's common sense. Like if it's one thing to say, you know, we want these immunities, and look, and they do say this in court, whenever they argue for Section 230 immunities, they say, we take no responsibility for what's on our site. We can't control it. We're just the innocent guy trying to do the right thing here. In all reality, they're not. We found out now they pull a lot of levers. They raise the volume on certain people. They turn the volume down on other people without the American consumer even knowing when that's happened. That is highly inappropriate, and we should be rewarding them by giving them civil immunities. I think that's at that point we've reached from this is weird to categorically absurd.
Well, so just a follow up: is this more legislation from Congress needed, or is this like a new commissioner to regulate this and the relevant agencies to regulate that and determine whether they're violating these terms or whether they should have the Section 230 immunity or not? Like, who would decide that? How does that get processed at the federal level?
My argument has always been for the legislator. And look, states are doing it. I think states are really doing the yeoman's work on this. And we have, you know, the state legislator in Texas should, you know, really be applauded for taking that first step, evaluating the case law, finding a reasonable solution, and putting that forward. But in all reality, Section 230 is a federal problem because it's a federal law. If you really do want, because like I think there's one of two options. One is that we have the Supreme Court pare back the reading of Section 230 to say it only applies in specific instances. That is an option. But I think the more likely option would be to have Congress write a law that says specifically, this is when Section 230 applies, this is when it doesn't apply. Because I actually am a fan of Section 230 in certain instances. I don't think platforms should be responsible for literally everything that goes onto their platforms. But there are times when they do materially engage with this content where it's impossible for me to say that you're not at least involved in some of, or you don't at least subscribe to some of the things that you're pushing. And I think we saw that with COVID-19 and how they were pushing specific talking points that didn't seem to be coming from the users. It seemed to be coming from something else. And I think it's pretty clear now where it was coming from. And I'm sorry, my light is like, my light keeps going off and on. But but to sum it all up, I think it really does come down to something very specific. And that is congressional action. Because in lieu of that, we're going to have to rely on the courts. And good luck with that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, let's talk just briefly, like the Twitter files revealed, which we knew was there, this intelligence agency collusion. I guess I don't even know if you want to call it collusion, but they sort of were threatening big tech. They got involved. They started, regulating content, for lack of a better word. We know for instance, during COVID that the Biden administration would send over memos to Facebook and other social media saying, you know, we got to get RFK Jr. out. We got to do this. You got to get this post out. And big tech's response was, we're on it. We're doing it. And there was this corporate government collusion going on. How did that come about? what can we do about that legislatively? Why in the world are intelligence agencies embedded in, you know, formerly Twitter and Facebook and other social media apps? Just explain that to make sense to all of us. Because I still, you know, again, this isn't my issue that I focus a lot on, but I've seen the reports. It just seems mind-boggling. How did this come about and what does it all mean?
Well, in all reality, so this goes to, few people have labeled it purely a government issue, where they'll say the government came in and the tech companies are just so worried about, you know, getting regulated, and they'll do whatever the government says to avoid that. And I don't actually think the Twitter file said that. I think the Twitter file said that there was definitely that hue of it, but it looked to me like the government was a welcome participant. Yes. It's almost as if Facebook or Twitter or TikTok or any of these social media companies, I think that fit very well with their internal corporate culture. And they were more than happy to, you know, take notes from HHS or they take Fauci talking points. I'm not convinced that they were so threatened and terrified that the big bad government was going to come and regulate them, because it hasn't happened since 1996. We haven't had any real meaningful legislation since 1996, outside of a few different actions, which still were pretty much watered down and pared down. So I don't believe that that's what happened. My instinct is that there is a corporate culture that exists within these companies where they have a certain belief system and they needed to justify it somehow. And I think that's what the Twitter files actually said, because look, there's nothing in the Twitter files for shutting down Kellyanne Conway. It was one of Trump's press secretaries who was trying to send around the Biden laptop story. There was nothing in there where it said the government sent this memo to Facebook and Facebook took it down. Facebook took it down on their own accord. And so again, I think that lends more to it being more of a corporate culture issue than a government jawboning issue. But to resolve the problem, I think is exactly what I described, which is why don't we tether public accommodation or non-discrimination laws to their Section 230 immunities? For one, that's enough pushback for them, at least to protect them against the government. They can say ultimately, look, if we do that, we're in threat of losing our Section 230 immunity. So sorry, Biden administration, kick rocks. We're out just to, you know, provide this particular type of service, versus what they have now, which is, well, we can do whatever we want. We can listen to whoever we want. We can invite anyone into our boardroom and they can decide what our curation practices are. I think the current system right now is untenable, and you're starting to see that basically on a bipartisan basis. There's several different senators and congressional members who are calling for Section 230 reform. And I think it's because, look, we're all seeing the same thing. This is an emperor has no pants moment, in case anyone isn't aware.
Well, all right, we have to take a break. We're talking with Joel Thayer, of the president of the Digital Progress Institute. When we come back, tick tock. I want to talk to you about that. And I also want to talk to you briefly about what happened with Donald Trump, because it seems like all of this happened in response to his election, the mass increase in censorship. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Joel Thayer. We'll be right back after these messages.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Asthma is a growing problem, especially among children. Asthma affects the quality of life for millions like me every single day. My name is Chris Draff, and I have asthma. And I've spent more than a decade in the NFL tackling asthma on and off the field. Join me in the EPA in helping people control their asthma. Asthma is a lung condition that can be controlled through medication and by avoiding things that can make it worse. Three steps are the solution to controlling asthma. Step one, talk to a doctor. Step two, make a plan. And step three, get rid of things that can make it worse. Asthma can be tackled. For more information on asthma, log on to epa.gov/asthma.
Taking no prisoners, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Tick tock, tick tock. All right, sorry about that. This is Mark Morano Unleashed. Welcome back on TNT. We're talking with Joel Thayer, president of the Digital Progress Institute. We're going to be talking about the TikTok potential ban here in a moment. But before we get there, I just had one question for you. Just as a social media user, and I've been on mostly Twitter, the old Twitter. I mean, I'm on new Twitter X, but I'm talking about just over the years and also YouTube and just Google. When Donald Trump was elected, and I dealt with the climate issue full time, everything seemed to change, not just on big tech, but in the media, because it was almost like a memo went out, like this guy got elected. We can never allow this again. I'm talking about academia, corporate media, the government, and they all decided that any of the ideas that Donald Trump presented, particularly climate skepticism, would have to be started to be censored and banned. And I noticed it heavily right after the time Donald Trump, everything became different. We are, you know, movie, whether it was Facebook and ad banning and restrictions and content. Is there some truth that this whole acceleration of sort of the censorship happened as a response to Trump's election, or was that just a coincidence? How would you describe the acceleration of censorship and control by these big tech firms and the timeline? Did it relate to Trump at all in your view?
I think it predated Trump a bit, because if you look at how all these tech companies actually, look, the tech companies haven't been hiding the ball on, you know, where they land ideologically. There's a really interesting novel called World Without Mind. And I think it's Franklin Foyer who wrote it, who articulates exactly the overall mindset of a lot of these companies. These companies, they have a worldview. There's no doubt about it. They see the world in a very specific way, and they create their technologies to essentially push out that view. And I think the Trump issue is hard only because he himself is a reaction to other things. And so these are two. Yeah. I think really what you're seeing is this will probably sum it up. I think this is what we're watching is when an immovable object meets an unstoppable force, and and so these things can't live in the same world. So I think both of them are trying to struggle with how do we navigate this? Like, how do we? If you're a company with a worldview and this guy who's been elected president doesn't fit in that worldview, how do you, you know, push him out? Well, you silence him on the platforms. And frankly, there was a lot of silencing happening, not just on Twitter, but like all across the board. And it's pretty clear that these companies have very specific perspectives. And if you don't align with them, they'll cut you off. Like, ask Apple when they shut down any app. Parler, for instance, ask Parler. Like, Parler, like, felt the ire of Apple just because, you know, it happened to be a free speech app. And, you know, even though every other app was pushing the same materials, they're the ones that got knocked off the internet almost within a day. And if they don't like you, they will get rid of you. And this goes back to your original concern. And I think all of our original concern, even President Trump's original concern, that is that this concentrated power over our networks and communication systems is scary. And it's something that we have to tackle. So in terms of like who started it, I mean, you might as well ask me who started the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't know.
Yeah, well said. That's a good analogy. Yeah, that's good. All right, one other thing on Twitter, I think this was their old terms of service policy. They had something, a very simple policy on censorship. It basically said, if you're doing something illegal against the laws of the United States or your local jurisdiction, we will remove your ban, do whatever, censor. However, if not, we believe in free speech. That changed, if I'm not mistaken, around 2015, 16. I've seen on the internet a whole movement of people, of experts saying that Twitter should, X under Elon Musk, should just go back to their previous policy. Basically, if it's illegal, we'll ban it. Otherwise, we're not going to get involved. Or if it's, you know, threatening overtly or, you know, But what do you think of that? Is there any truth to, could they ever just go back to a simple policy? Could Elon Musk do that? And last question rolled into that is Elon Musk, he's doing a lot, but I still feel like there's shadow banning and all kinds of restrictions. I get reports. He hired someone from the World Economic Forum to manage X. Is he really the savior of social media free speech?
So you're talking to someone who has never believed that he was a free speech advocate. I mean,
he's
look,
he's more self-interested, I think. And I think his interests converged. But yeah, continue. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think there's a melding of the minds there. Certainly because I look at his actions more than I look at his words. Like, yes, he's absolutely right. So he's been the first guy to say, look, Twitter, something was wrong with Twitter. There was a cancer in Twitter. And the cancer was the actual corporate culture. And he did address it, like, to his credit. He did address a lot of the problems, but you can't get, like, Rome wasn't built in a day, and you can't redo Twitter in a few years. And so I think the other thing he noticed as well is, like, well, I don't like it when people say mean things about me or Tesla or all my other, all my other stuff that I also have stuff.
Ex-affiliated enterprises.
And you see, like, he's done it. He's turned down his competitors on his own platform. He hasn't really pushed out free speech things. He does pick and choose who gets on his platform, who gets off his platform. And so, like, it's sort of like, okay, a billionaire goes back on his word. Another news water wet. You know, it's one of those things where I think if all of our eggs are in that basket where we are trying to pin all of our hopes on a billionaire to give us what we think is free speech, then we're in trouble. And I don't think it is Elon Musk's responsibility. I don't think it is. It should never have been his responsibility. It shouldn't cost multiple billions of dollars to have a platform do what it says it's supposed to do. In its terms of service, like, even if you were, you don't even have to be a lawyer to do, just read it. They say it's an open forum for a conversation. Don't do illegal stuff. Well, right. Even with that stuff, they still turn up the volume, turn down the volume. It's, again, this goes back to consumer protection, and this goes, that's a role for the government. That's not a role for Elon Musk. I'm very skeptical of billionaires who say they can give you something, because I'm a big Milton Friedman guy. And as he said, nothing's for free. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And so I just don't think social media or Elon Musk is capable of giving us that free lunch.
All right. TikTok. What's the problem with TikTok? Now, just a little background. My daughters, I have three daughters, the two older ones, now they're now in their 20s, but the two young, older ones were all into Musical.ly when it first started. And we ended up thinking it was inappropriate. It was all full of, you know, young kids dancing around, and we didn't know who was lurking. And there was kind of a creepy app. And then it was changed the name to TikTok. It was always Chinese owned, correct?
That is my understanding. Yeah.
Okay. So the question is, what happened? Has it always been bad? What's the problem with it? Is it an official tool or official arm of the Chinese government to spy on Americans? Explain the problem with TikTok.
Oh, man. Well, the good news is it gives me a lot to work with. So I know. So I'll start. I'm happy to start. So I think let's start with the basics. So TikTok's relationship with ByteDance has been an issue for the US for almost since its inception. In the 5 years since Trump first pursued a ban on the app in 2020, like, we have found out so much more about the Chinese government's control over ByteDance and, by extension, TikTok. Like, we know that ByteDance had an internal Chinese Communist Party committee as part of its government structure since at least 2017. And that was to better align itself with Beijing policies. We also know that ByteDance agreed to promote the credibility of Chinese police, like, for their Chinese Ministry of Public Security, Press, and Propaganda Bureau. And now we're even getting a better sense of ByteDance's relationship with TikTok. So let's just start with its leadership. So TikTok CEO served as ByteDance CFO for most of 2021. And before that was the president of an international operations for a technology company that the Pentagon considered a Chinese communist military company. So unless we forget the now infamous master admin, like based in Beijing, like who had access to all of Americans' data. And that's something that TikTok representative promised under oath in Congress that no one in China had access to American data. Turns out that's not so. Like, and also, like, how do we look at the fact that ByteDance has admitted to tracking at least two US-based journalists using TikTok? And also reports are showing that ByteDance had in fact intended to use TikTok to monitor specific American citizens. Like we know they're still doing it. So the fact that it's not banned already is kind of bizarre, or at least, but frankly, the ban, most of the measures here aren't calling for a ban. They're just saying a divestiture. They're just saying, look, TikTok, feel free to do whatever you want, but you can't do it under this corporate umbrella. You can't have ByteDance with all of these problems embedded in it. Sorry, you either get rid of the ByteDance connection or you leave. And TikTok has said that it's a ban. It's not in the law. If they want to stay here, they know what to do. It's a basic foreign ownership law. We have it in every other communication system. It's exactly why Putin can't buy a radio station or purchase a radio license from the FCC. Same principle. Don't understand what the issue is.
Well, I mean, who would enforce? Let's say it's a ban. Let's say they say, no, we're not changing our structure. What agency, what department would ban it? And just to be clear, does TikTok have a website that anyone goes to, or it's strictly an app? Is that correct? It's only an app?
No. So they have TikTok.com, and the law. So if we're talking about the bill that's currently getting debated in Congress right now, that would include that specific website, not all websites, just websites associated with any app that has an adverse foreign ownership.
And then what about the app as well would be banned, is what you're saying, if they didn't.
The app and the website, yeah.
Okay, so what agency is in charge? That means Google Play, Apple Store would not be able to offer it as an app to anyone, correct? If there's banned, obviously.
Correct. It's just,
so what agency, where would this ban, who would enforce that is what I'm asking you. Is this Federal Trade Commission or which agency?
It's the Attorney General. Like, so it's under the purview of the Attorney General. And they're only in charge of just, like, once the determination has been made by the president that a certain company is owned and operated and controlled by a adversarial foreign owner, then they would, the Department of Justice are the ones that would actually do all the enforcement mechanisms and impose the fines, and which is mainly what it is. You're mainly imposing fines on companies like Apple or Google, or even hosting services like AWS. Your basic question is like, who's enforcing it? It would be the Attorney General of the United States.
So there's been a lot of pushback against this. I was just looking, Governor Sununu of New Hampshire does not favor any kind of ban. What if you just inform people, and what if you inform Apple and Google? I'm worried that, you know, the president, which is, again, this is a partisan thing, and the Attorney General, again, appointed by the president, what if they just start determining, much the way after 9/11, they called America, they had the surveillance state, well, we'll never use it against Americans. They ended up using it against Americans. They used certain laws. The Attorney General called parents at school board meetings domestic terrorists. Why should we give in and allow that precedent, or that precedent, because you said it's, but why should we allow this? I almost think it's better to have Chinese spying on us than it is to give the Biden administration that kind of power to determine what they can ban. It gives me shades of, what's the app again that was banned? Dan Bongino, what was it called again?
I don't know the reference.
You referenced it earlier, the app that they pulled off the store.
Parler,
yeah, that part, it gives me shades of Parler. So how do you answer the critics like that? Because that's, I hear both sides. I'm very conflicted because I haven't studied it. But what do you respond to that?
So my response is that, like, this bill is very targeted and narrowly tailored. It would be very hard for them to do something like that. And again, like, if you look at the way the bill is structured, it's focused on something very, very specific. It's only looking at adverse foreign ownership. And that means it's the purview of this rule is really only looking at ownership that's actually controlled through after an investigation by China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. So Parler wouldn't fall into that category. Neither would Twitter. Actually, neither would Telegram, for that matter.
Okay. And we're out of time, but thank you so much, Joel. I appreciate you taking the time. Joel Thayer, Digital Progress Unleashed with Mark Morano. See you next time.